This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa ma takunu fi sha'ni وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
Thank you.
nearly a dozen Palestinians are killed in an Israeli airstrike in south of Gaza as the regime's genocide rages on across the besieged territory. Hundreds of Israeli protesters clash with the regime forces during fresh demonstrations against Netanyahu outside his Likud party headquarters in Tel Aviv. And Iran reiterates that it does not seek war with any country, but it will not hesitate to defend itself at the highest level of readiness and capability. Israeli forces' air and artillery strikes continue to kill more Palestinians in Gaza as the regime's genocide rages on across the besieged territory. One of the latest attacks killed 10 civilians and wounded many others in the Al-Manara neighborhood of the southern city of Khan Yunis. A Palestinian woman was killed and several others injured in bombardment of a tent housing displaced people west of Khan Yunis. Another Palestinian was killed in an airstrike on a water desalination plant east of the At-Tofah neighborhood of Gaza City. The new fatalities came after an airstrike on a school sheltering displaced people east of Gaza City killed over 30 civilians, most of them children, and injured more than 100 others. According to local media, one of the children killed in the attack on the Dar al-Arkam school in the At-Tofah neighborhood was the two-year-old grandson of Khalil al-Hayya, the Hamas leader in Gaza. The new casualties increased the toll from renewed Israeli onslaught on Gaza since March the 18th to nearly 1,200 deaths and over 2,700 injuries. The overall death toll from the regime's genocide now stands at 50,500, with nearly 114,800 others injured. For more on this, let us go to Gaza City and talk to our own correspondent, Ghada Ibrahim. Ghada, what are the latest situation in Gaza?
Yes, Ahmed, as you may expect, Gaza has gone through a very tough night, especially after the massacre of Dar al-Arqam in At-Tufah, eastern of the Gaza city. This massacre was very huge, and the casualties were almost 40. Many of them are children and women. Some of the casualties are still missing under the rubble, and there is no available means of extracting the bodies or the missing casualties from under the rubble because of the weak capabilities of the civil defense workers here. Another massacre was just in the past few hours against the local market in Ash-Shaja'iya neighborhood that left at least one martyr and a lot of injuries as well. As you know, it is Friday. People gather in the center of Ash-Shaja'iya in order to have a very simple and humble market for the essentials. However, the Israeli airstrike targeted the gathering of people, killed one and injured many of them. Another airstrike targeted At-Tufah's only desalination water pump that gives the water for the whole of the area of At-Tufah, Ash-Shaja'iya, and the eastern parts of the city. Now, these parts of the city of Gaza do not have water, actually. And the airstrikes do not stop. Every passing hour, the death toll increases and rises rapidly. At least since yesterday until now, at least 130 Palestinians have been killed, and the number is expected to rise because of the continuous airstrikes and because there are still many buried under the rubble and the weak capabilities of the civil defense workers who cannot actually extract the bodies or the casualties from under the rubble. So 130 Palestinians, those who arrived to the hospital here, many are still were not able to come to the hospital, as you know.
Well, Ghada, according to the UN, and we had a general session on the UN Security Council regarding the Israeli genocide and especially the attack on the ambulances and the 15 first responders who were killed in the attack. What measures are being taken by the international community?
Actually, the silence of the international community regarding or before these atrocities or crimes is deafening. No international response towards the crimes the Israeli occupation is committing against the ambulances, the medical crew, and the UN workers, actually. The Israeli army continues to commit more crimes without any deterrence. They crossed all the red lines, and no one is, even the condemnation we used to hear before is nowhere to be heard nowadays. The Israeli army continues to commit more crimes without any deterrence or without any international condemnation towards what's happening now. Early in the previous night, the Israeli army issued evacuation orders to most of the areas of Gaza, not only Ash-Shuja'iyah and At-Tufah neighborhoods, but also the areas of western Gaza, like Tell el-Hawa, Arimal neighborhood, and the areas that the people were actually are being displaced to. Now these places are having evacuation orders. Even the place where I am now, the old city of Gaza, which is where we are now, is the Israeli army issued evacuation orders to these places as well. So the situation is very chaotic now. Every place is threatened, and the people have nowhere else to go. There is no safe place in Gaza, and the people are moving without any destination. They don't know where to go amidst the Israeli bombardment, relentless bombardment, and amidst the evacuation orders.
Thank you, Ghada, for the update. Ghada Ibrahim in Gaza City. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has strongly condemned Israel's deadly attacks on the world body's facilities in Gaza. The UNRWA chief called the regime's attacks a violation of international law, demanding an independent investigation into them. Philippe Lazzarini made the remarks while slamming Israel's targeting of an UNRWA building in northern Gaza, which killed 9 children. He said since October 2023, more than 300 UN buildings have been damaged or destroyed by Israel, and over 700 people have been killed while seeking UN protection. Lazzarini's remarks came as the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights slapped Israel's March 23rd attack on a number of ambulances, killing 15 medics and humanitarian workers. Addressing the UN Security Council, Walker Turk said the appalling attack raises concerns over the commission of war crimes by Israel. He also condemned Israel's ban on the entry of humanitarian aid to Gaza for a month. Turk said the blockade of Gaza constitutes a form of collective punishment and may also amount to the use of starvation as a method of war. Let us now go to Melbourne and talk to Samuel Geddes, Al-Mayadeen's contributor and political analyst. Very good to have you on the program, Samuel. How do these attacks align with the international humanitarian law, and what legal action could be pursued?
Thank you for having me. Well, they evidently don't align with international law whatsoever. I don't think that means that we can expect any serious measures beyond legal action to differentiate from them. We obviously have the genocide case having been brought by South Africa in The Hague, currently in process, but that will probably be ongoing for many months, if not years, before it reaches a verdict. And even when it does, it is entirely unclear that there will be any mechanism for enforcing whatever verdict it comes to. We are really, unfortunately, back in the same situation we were prior to the January ceasefire, with an American administration that has no interest at all in reining in the Israeli government, whose head has every interest in keeping this conflict going for as long as possible and in expanding it as far as possible. The only realistic means by which this might be countered that I can imagine are, other than direct resistance by the targets of these atrocities, which are of course ongoing, but also the civil disobedience of people within Israel who do not wish to live in this constant state of war, which it seems very much a coin toss as to whether enough of a critical mass of people are willing to actually take action to enforce an end to the war, but that very much remains to be seen.
Right, Samuel, but the thing is, you know, what do you think are the goals of the Israeli regime by attacking UN facilities? What could be the goal and purpose behind all of that?
Well, the obvious goal would simply be to eliminate the ability of anyone to survive within the area being attacked, so the Gaza Strip. So it falls perfectly in line with the objective to make surviving in that area impossible, so that people either in very big quotation marks voluntarily leave, or they are simply killed. That is evidently the end goal of the Israelis doing this.
And Samuel, one final question. What do you think the international community now can do, aside from what the General Council, Special Council at the UN, what do you think the international community can do and must do?
Well, I certainly wouldn't expect the organs of the UN to take any meaningful action, especially not the Security Council. I think it really falls to individual states around the world acting on their own and collectively with others. We have seen this, the beginnings of this, I think, being led by the Malaysian government, enforcing their own multilateral or unilateral sanctions against Israel, so effectively globalizing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which has absolutely moved into the mainstream in the last year and a half, and there is no way that that is going to be reversed. So really, I would imagine the most effective action in the hands of people around the world, and especially governments, is to enact sanctions, financial, military, political sanctions. That would seem to be the tactic that would have the greatest chance of actually producing results in reining in Israeli and American behavior.
Thank you, Samuel. Very interesting to get your perspective on the matter. Samuel Geddes, Al-Mayadeen's contributor and political analyst, talking to us from Melbourne. Hundreds of protesters have clashed with Israeli forces during fresh demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu outside the headquarters of his Likud party in Tel Aviv. The protest was attended by various groups, including the relatives of the Israeli captives held by Hamas. They demanded the regime to stop violating the Gaza ceasefire deal and bring the captives back. Some protesters marched from the Hungarian embassy in Tel Aviv, denouncing Netanyahu's visit to the European country that began on Thursday. The Israeli Prime Minister's European trip was made in complete defiance of an arrest warrant issued for him by the International Criminal Court. The scuffles come amid a rise in demonstrations across the occupied territories and increasing discontent with Netanyahu's cabinet after the onslaught on Gaza resumed. Another source of protest is Netanyahu's attempt to remove Shin Bet's head, Ronan Bar, who has presided over the investigation into a corruption case involving three of Netanyahu's aides. Israeli violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank continues unabated. The regime forces have killed a Palestinian man in the city of Jenin. The victim, named Hussein Hadan, was shot dead during an Israeli raid. In a separate incident, Israeli forces shot another Palestinian youth near Bethlehem over alleged stone throwing at settler vehicles. The youth was later pronounced dead as he had received critical injuries to his upper body. Israeli violence in the West Bank was not limited to deadly raids by the regime troops. Reports say Israeli settlers attacked a village near Salfit. The settlers set a Palestinian-owned vehicle on fire and threw Molotov cocktails at homes filled with civilians. Violent raids by Israeli soldiers and settlers have significantly increased across the West Bank since the Gaza genocide began. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian says the Islamic Republic has never sought war with any country or will not hesitate to defend itself at the highest level of readiness and capability. Pezeshkian made the remarks in a phone call with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman while addressing US's threats against Iran's nuclear sites. He reaffirmed that non-peaceful use of nuclear energy has no place in Iran's defense doctrine. Pezeshkian expressed Iran's readiness for dialogue to ease some existing tensions based on mutual interest and respect. He also touched on the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Pezeshkian said if Muslim nations become united, they can end the Zionist regime's crimes against the people of Gaza. The Saudi Crown Prince, for his part, said cooperation among regional countries is key to region's peace and stability. Pezeshkian also spoke with chairman of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat. He said if Muslim countries were united, arrogant powers could not take any act of aggression against them. An Israeli airstrike on Lebanon's southern port of city of Sidon has killed at least three people. The attack targeted a multi-story apartment in Lebanon's third largest city. According to reports, Hamas official is among the victims. The airstrike followed earlier Israeli attacks which hit the Alma Ashab and Nakura areas of south of Lebanon. Israel has repeatedly violated the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon, and the regime has defied calls to adhere to its obligations under the agreement, including the withdrawal of its forces from south of Lebanon. And that is a wrap for this hour's World News. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
The limelight. As solidarity with Palestine has increasingly expanded from the global south to the global majority, Arabs remain largely ineffective. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, explaining Arab political failure to challenge the Zionist regime through traditional analysis, such as disunity, general weakness, and a failure to prioritize Palestine, does not capture the full picture. The idea that Israel is brutalizing Palestinians simply because the Arabs are too weak to challenge the child killer Benjamin Netanyahu government or any government implies that, in theory, Arab regimes could unite around Palestine. However, this view oversimplifies the matter. Many well-meaning pro-Palestine commentators have long urged Arab nations to unite, pressure Washington to reassess its unwavering support for Israel, and take decisive actions to lift the siege on Gaza, among other crucial steps. While these steps may hold some value, the reality is far more complex, and such wishful thinking is unlikely to change the behavior of Arab governments. These regimes are more concerned with sustaining or returning to some form of a status quo, one in which Palestine's liberation remains a secondary priority. Since the start of the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza on October 7, 2023, the Arab position on Israel has been weak at best and treasonous at worst. Some Arab governments even went so far as to condemn Palestinian resistance in the United Nations debates. While countries like China and Russia at least attempt to contextualize the October 7 Al-Aqsa Storm operation on Israeli occupation forces, imposing a brutal siege on Gaza, countries like Bahrain place the blame squarely on the Palestinians. With a few exceptions, it took Arab governments weeks or even months to develop a relatively strong stance that condemned the Zionist regime's offensive in any meaningful terms. Though the rhetoric began to shift slowly, the actions did not follow. While the Ansarullah movement in Yemen, alongside other non-Arab state actors, attempt to impose some form of pressure on the Zionist regime through a blockade, Arab countries instead worked to ensure Israel could withstand the potential consequences of its isolation. In his book, War, Bob Woodward disclosed that some Arab governments told then-US Secretary of State Antony Blinken that they had no objections to Israel's efforts to crush Palestinian resistance. However, some were concerned about the media images of mutilated Palestinian civilians, which could stir public unrest in their own countries. That public unrest never materialized, and with time, the genocide, famine, and cries for help in Gaza were normalized as yet another tragic event, not like the war in Sudan or the strife in Syria. For 15 months of relentless Israeli genocide that resulted in the killing and wounding of over 162,000 Palestinians in Gaza, official Arab political institutions remained largely irrelevant in ending the war. The U.S. Biden administration was emboldened by such Arab inaction, continuing to push for greater normalization between Arab countries and Israel, even in the face of over 15,000 children killed in Gaza in the most brutal ways imaginable. While the moral failures of the West, the shortcomings of international law, and the criminal actions of Biden and his administration have been widely criticized for serving as a shield for Israel's war crimes, the complicity of Arab governments in enabling these atrocities is often ignored. The Arabs have, in fact, played a more significant role in the Israeli regime atrocities in Gaza than we often recognize, some through their silence and others through direct collaboration with the child killer regime of Israel. Throughout the war, reports surfaced indicating that some Arab countries actively lobbied in Washington on behalf of Israel, advocating against an Egyptian Arab League proposal aimed at reconstructing Gaza without ethnically cleansing its population, an idea promoted by the Trump administration and the Zionist regime. The Egyptian proposal, which was unanimously accepted by Arab countries at their summit on March 4th, represented the strongest and most unified stance taken by the Arab world during the war. The proposal, which was rejected by the Zionist regime and dismissed by the United States, helped shift discourse in the U.S. around the subject of ethnic cleansing. It ultimately led to comments made on March 12th by Trump during a meeting with Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin, which is stated that no one's expelling anyone from Gaza. For some Arab states, to actively oppose the only relatively strong Arab position signals that the issue of Arab failures in Palestine goes beyond mere disunity or incompetence. It reflects a much darker and more cynical reality. Some Arabs align their interests with Israel, where a free Palestine isn't just a non-issue, but a threat. The same applies to the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, which continues to work hand-in-hand with the Israeli regime to suppress any form of resistance in the West Bank. Its concern in Gaza is not about ending the genocide, but ensuring the marginalization of its Palestinian rivals, particularly Hamas. Thus, blaming the PA for mere weakness, for not doing enough, or for failing to unify the Palestinian ranks is a misreading of the situation. The priorities of Mahmoud Abbas and his PA allies are far different: securing relative power over Palestinians, a power that can only be sustained through Israeli military dominance. These are difficult, yet critical truths, as they allow us to reframe the conversation, moving away from the false assumption that Arab unity will resolve everything. The flaw in the unity theory is that it naively assumes Arab regimes inherently reject Israeli occupation and support Palestine. While some Arab governments are genuinely outraged by Israel's criminal behavior and growingly frustrated by the U.S. irrational policies in the region, others are driven by self-interest, their animosity toward rising Arab non-state actors. They are equally concerned about instability in the region, which threatens their hold on power amid a rapidly shifting world order. As solidarity with Palestine has increasingly expanded from the global south to the global majority, Arabs remain largely ineffective, fearing that significant political change in the region could directly challenge their own position. What they fail to understand is that their silence or their active support for the Zionist regime may very well lead to their own downfall.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Midstream.
In the holy city of Al-Quds, every stone tells a story, and every alley echoes with the defiant heartbeat of a city that has refused to surrender. It is a place where oppression and resistance collide daily, where the occupier tightens its grip, yet the spirit of its people remains unbreakable. Since the Al-Aqsa flood operation, the Israeli occupation has turned Al-Quds into a military fortress. Checkpoints choking its streets, soldiers spreading fear, and policies designed to erase its Palestinian identity. Raids, arrests, demolitions, and the silencing of voices have become the daily reality. But history has already spoken. Al-Quds is not a city that kneels. Here, young men and women stand at the front line of defiance. They are not warriors with conventional weapons, yet their resistance shakes the very foundations of the occupier's illusion of control. They throw stones, they resist eviction, they refuse to bow to the reality imposed upon them. For them, resistance is not a choice, it is existence itself. They carry in their hearts the words of the martyr Basil al-Arash: "It is not enough to seek revenge, you must exact it wisely." And so, with every act of resistance, Al-Quds speaks. It speaks in the faces of its youth who refuse to be uprooted, in the prayers that rise above the calls of occupation, in the steadfast homes that, even when reduced to rubble, refuse to die. On its designated International Quds Day, Al-Quds will once again take its rightful place in the conscience of the free peoples of the world, carrying with it the names, voices, and slogans brimming with hope and certainty. It will be present in marches calling for the escalation of resistance in its name, where young voices will chant familiar slogans tied to Al-Quds, the prisoners, the martyrs, and the struggle. To Al-Quds, we will march, martyrs by the millions. These chants fuel an undying resolve for return and liberation. These words are not mere slogans. They are a declaration of an unbreakable will. As the genocide in Gaza rages on, Al-Quds does not stand in silence. Every stone, every street, every corner of the city carries the weight of blood spilled, of lives taken, of dreams denied. Yet the people of Al-Quds remain on the path of resistance, while free peoples across the world stand with the Palestinians in marking International Al-Quds Day. These demonstrations renew awareness, deepen commitment, and reaffirm the centrality of Palestine and Al-Quds, a city that, as Imam Khomeini once declared, will forever remain in our memory, sharpening our resolve and mobilizing us for its liberation from the filth of Zionists and settlers. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Al-Quds, where every street tells a story of defiance and every stone stands witness to a struggle that refuses to fade. Under occupation, the city faces relentless raids, arrests, and demolitions, yet its people remain unshaken. Their resistance, a testament to an unbreakable will. As the world marks International Al-Quds Day, we dive into the heart of the battle for Palestine's eternal capital and the voices that refuse to be silenced. To discuss with us from Beirut is Mr. Fadi Boudaya, who's a political commentator. It's a pleasure having you with us, Mr. Fadi. Now, after all the sacrifices made on the path to liberating Palestine, how does International Al-Quds Day reinforce the centrality of resistance, and what message does it send to both the occupier and the free peoples of the world?
Greetings to you. When we speak of Al-Quds Day, we are not merely discussing a religious, ethnic, or nationalist issue. It is, at its core, a battle between justice and oppression in the most profound humanitarian sense. We are talking about a people who have endured genocide and mass displacement, whose land has been occupied since 1948 before the eyes of the entire world. Despite the countless UN Security Council resolutions issued over the decades, none have been able to compel Israel to withdraw from Palestinian lands, respect Palestinian rights, or even meet the bare minimum of establishing a Palestinian state with recognized sovereignty. This is why the resistance became the only path, the only means to confront and expel the occupier and to keep the Palestinian cause alive. International Quds Day embodies this very struggle. The struggle of a people deeply rooted in their land, resisting aggression and colonization, sacrificing for their homeland in pursuit of its liberation. History has taught us this lesson time and again, whether in Cuba, Vietnam, France, or anywhere else in the world where people have resisted occupation. They did not wait for international resolutions, because such resolutions have never resolved conflicts. Liberation has always been achieved through resistance. And if this holds true for nations throughout history, how much more so for Palestine, a cause that lies at the heart of every regional and global struggle in both the Arab and Islamic worlds. Over time, the Palestinian cause has transcended borders and become a universal humanitarian issue, championed by all free people of the world who demand a just resolution. That resolution, however, will never come through failed international resolutions that have repeatedly proven powerless in the face of the Zionist entity. The only true solution lies in resistance, armed with willpower, awareness, and the determination to continue this struggle until justice prevails.
Well, Mr. Fadi, you know, Gaza, as you just said and explained, it endures one of the most brutal and relentless assaults in history. How does Al-Quds Day serve as a beacon of hope and possibly a solidarity with its people who have lost some hope? And in what ways does the resistance view this day as maybe an extension of the actual ongoing battle for Palestine?
The Zionist enemy operates under the illusion that oppressing and breaking the will of nations will ultimately lead to their surrender. However, history has shown that for nations that are free, alive and conscious, suffering does not breed submission. It fuels an unyielding determination to reclaim their land, no matter the cost in sacrifice and blood. Honorable people, those with clear minds and unwavering vision, understand that no matter how great the sacrifices, no matter how heavy the price in blood, such suffering must serve as a beacon that illuminates the path of resistance towards liberation. History offers countless lessons. Take, for example, Operation Barbarossa, where millions of Russians perished in the fight against Nazi Germany. Yet, rather than breaking their spirit, this immense suffering became the driving force behind their ultimate victory and the liberation of their homeland. The Palestinian people, particularly in Gaza, have endured oppression since 1948. But the sheer brutality of the Zionist entity has reached unfathomable levels this year. Before the eyes of the world, children are slaughtered, their bodies left to be devoured by stray dogs in the streets. Women are forcibly displaced, and the scale of humanitarian catastrophe is unlike anything recorded in modern history. And yet, despite all this, the Palestinian people continue to resist, hold steadfast to their land, and grow stronger in their resolve. The struggle is not fading. It is being passed down, generation after generation, creating an unstoppable force committed to the dream of liberating Palestine. This is why every Palestinian refugee who carries the key to their ancestral home does so with an unshakable belief in their right to return, a powerful symbol of their claim to their land and their refusal to surrender. The Palestinian people embody the essence of resilience and humanity, and those who stand in solidarity with them, whether through demonstrations, activism, or armed resistance across the Arab and Islamic world, are part of this shared struggle for justice. It is also crucial to recognize the Palestinian cause is not an issue of Muslims alone. It is a cause that concerns Muslims, Christians, and all free people across the world. We must understand that Palestine is not just a religious or national issue. It is a cause of universal human justice.
Well, but we are at a time, honestly, of sinister conspiracies that are being woven to forcibly displace the people of Gaza under the guise of optional resettlement. How does the Axis of Resistance ensure that International Al-Quds Day remains a platform to expose and maybe to thwart these schemes while reaffirming the inevitability of Palestine's liberation?
When we talk about the plan for forced displacement, we are referring to a strategy deeply rooted in Israeli entity documents leaked as early as the 1950s and even before 1949. Numerous plans have surfaced over the years, but perhaps the most infamous among them is the Enon plan, the blueprint for what is known as Greater Israel. This plan revolves around the mass displacement of the Palestinian people, scattering them across the region to erase their presence from their homeland. What Donald Trump recently proposed regarding the forced expulsion of Palestinians is not new. It is merely a rehashing of the Enon plan itself. The document explicitly states that the people of Gaza should be deported to Egypt's Sinai, based on the fabricated claim that Sinai belongs to the so-called Jewish people. Likewise, it calls for the expulsion of West Bank Palestinians to Jordan, justified by distorted Talmudic narratives. Had the opportunity presented itself, even the Palestinians of 1948 would have been expelled to Lebanon. The ultimate goal is clear, the total liquidation of the Palestinian cause. A striking historical observation emerges when we examine past peace agreements. Egypt was the first Arab country to sign a peace treaty with the Zionist entity, and at its core was a commitment to establishing a Palestinian state. Jordan followed suit, signing its own treaty, also under the pretense of a future Palestinian state. The Oslo Accords between the Palestinian Authority and the Zionist entity were based on the promise of statehood. Even the so-called Abraham Accords, signed by four Arab nations, carried the same premise. From Egypt's peace treaty to the Abraham Accords, all these agreements ostensibly supported a Palestinian state. Yet the Zionist entity never upheld its end of the bargain. Even when discussions centered around the 1967 borders, which would have handed the Zionists 78% of historic Palestine while leaving Palestinians with a mere 22%, the occupier still refused to comply. We are faced with a regime driven by an insatiable desire to erase Palestine, uproot its people, and seize their history, culture, and civilization, all under the deafening silence of Arab regimes that claim to lead the Islamic world. Instead of confronting the real threat, these regimes deflect blame elsewhere, turning a blind eye to the Zionist entity's relentless aggression. But what does this silence produce? It sparks defiance among the free people of the region, from Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and Palestine, to Iran and beyond. It inspires movements that stand against Zionist barbarism, colonial expansion, and ethnic cleansing, refusing to let the Palestinian cause fade. Indeed, Palestine remains the central issue of the region. If a just resolution is found, it can pave the way for security and stability. But if Palestine is lost, the entire region will spiral into irreversible chaos. Anyone who believes that the Zionist entity will stop at the borders of Palestine is dangerously mistaken. The same colonial ambitions that drive them in Palestine extend to Jordan, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Iran, and Turkey. The threat is widespread, just as outlined in the Yanan Plan, which laid the foundation for the Greater Israel Project. Therefore, this is not merely a Palestinian responsibility. It is the duty of all who seek to protect their homelands. Defending Palestine is, first and foremost, an act of self-preservation, before it is even an act of solidarity.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Fadi Boudaya, political commentator, for joining us today and talking about this very important day for all Muslims and free peoples of the world, the International Al-Quds Day. Thank you very much, Ramadan Mubarak, for you and your entire family. And thank you for the contribution that you are making, whether in Arabic or with us here dubbing, because people need to listen to the people of the land. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the UAE's deception in Palestine.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
A new report exposes a troubling reality. While the UAE publicly aligns itself with the Arab consensus on Palestine, behind closed doors, it plays a very different role. Sources reveal that Abu Dhabi is actively pressuring Washington to reject the Arab League's Gaza plan, instead pushing a strategy that could lead to the mass displacement of Palestinians. More details in the following report.
In recent months, the United Arab Emirates has leveraged its unparalleled influence in Washington to undermine a regional initiative aimed at stabilizing Gaza. American and Egyptian officials confirmed that UAE diplomats led by its influential ambassador to Washington, Yusuf Al-Utaibi, are lobbying the Trump administration to reject the Arab League's Gaza proposal. The Emirati argument? The plan allegedly gives Hamas too much control, a claim dismissed by Egyptian officials who say the Palestinian Authority, not Hamas, would oversee Gaza's reconstruction. But the UAE's motivations appear to go far beyond concerns over Hamas. Abu Dhabi is championing an alternative, one that aligns seamlessly with the Zionist Israelis' long-standing goal, the mass displacement of Gazans. This is not speculation. Israeli entity media recently confirmed that the occupation authorities have already launched a pilot project to facilitate Palestinian immigration, with 100 Gazans recently sent to Indonesia for work. The ultimate goal, opening the floodgates for the permanent removal of thousands more. Meanwhile, protests have erupted in northern Gaza against the devastating humanitarian crisis, with Zionist Israel and its allies exploiting the suffering to stoke anger against Hamas. Yet, amid this turmoil, the UAE's duplicity remains evident. While publicly endorsing a two-state solution, Emirati officials privately advocate for Trump's so-called peace vision, which explicitly excludes Palestinian statehood. Notably, the UAE's 2020 normalization deal with Zionist Israel under the Abraham Accords made no reference to Palestinian sovereignty, an omission that speaks volumes. Even its humanitarian efforts in Gaza appear calculated. Although the UAE has sent aid convoys, a significant portion of its assistance has been funneled through Egypt, where profiteering by local intermediaries has reduced the actual relief reaching Gazans. Moreover, when Zionist Israel resumed its attacks in March 2025, the UAE remained conspicuously silent. The silence was particularly glaring as Abu Dhabi's national security advisor, Sheikh Tahmoud bin Zayed, met with Donald Trump in Washington just one day after the Israeli regime's renewed bombardment without any mention of Gaza's plight. It seems that the UAE's involvement in Gaza is not about humanitarianism or stability. It is about serving Zionist Israeli interests by facilitating Palestinian displacement. As Abu Dhabi tightens its grip on Washington's Middle East policy, the question remains, how long can it maintain this double game before the world takes notice?
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, political commentator and journalist at Al Akhbar Daily. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Hamza. Now, how does the United Arab Emirates' alignment with Zionist Israel's displacement agenda really reflect broader geopolitical shifts in the region of West Asia? And what do you think are the potential consequences for the entire Palestinian cause?
Naturally, the UAE functions as a client state within the framework of the American Zionist project in the region. The alignment between the Emirati leadership and this broader geopolitical agenda is significant, serving multiple strategic objectives. This has become particularly evident in the wake of the Zionist aggression against Lebanon and the ongoing assault on Palestine, an aggression that, according to Trump and his officials, aims to coerce Lebanon, Syria, and the entire region into normalization with the Zionist entity. Thus, the UAE's current actions undermine the Arab stance, particularly in negotiations. Historically, Arab leaders used the Palestinian cause as leverage in their dealings with the Zionist entity. While this was far from ideal, it at least provided some degree of resistance against full capitulation. However, with the post-Arab Spring wave of leadership, even this minimal leverage has vanished, leaving the Arab position significantly weaker. Moreover, the UAE's involvement is not limited to diplomacy. It extends to fostering division within Palestine itself. Resistance movements are now being smeared from within, accused of being Iranian proxies, as if Arabs have never historically defended their own land and sovereignty. This is a direct consequence of Emirati interference, aimed at reshaping the narrative and eroding popular support for the resistance. In Gaza specifically, the UAE is actively working to sow internal discord, funding and organizing unrest under the guise of a so-called Gazan uprising against the resistance. We have seen this manifest through social media campaigns, such as hashtags like Gaza Rises, alongside region-specific slogans like Khan Yunis Rises and Beit Lahia Rises. These efforts are not spontaneous expressions of dissent, but rather carefully orchestrated operations, backed by states that are openly aligned with the Zionist war effort. At its core, this Emirati intervention serves two main objectives. One, weakening internal Palestinian unity, making resistance movements appear illegitimate, and two, providing political and financial cover for the Zionist entity's ongoing massacre in Gaza. This is not mere political maneuvering. It is a direct assault on Palestinian resistance, executed both politically and militarily, and funded by those who have chosen to side with the occupier rather than the oppressed.
Well, Mr. Hamza, given that the United Arab Emirates' normalization with Zionist Israel under the Abraham Accords, which you just mentioned, and its efforts to marginalize Palestinian leadership in Gaza in specific, what do you think are the strategies that should be taken by the Palestinian resistance and adopted by them to counter this attempt and safeguard Palestinian sovereignty? And we know that it is a bit hard for them because they have been under pounding and bombs for the past 18 months.
It is indeed a difficult situation, as you mentioned. The Palestinian people have endured war, siege, and massacres for 18 months. But the challenge is further compounded by the Arab intervention, specifically from the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and even Qatar, into Palestinian internal affairs. This intervention has not only weakened the Palestinian negotiating position, but has also created significant divisions and contradictions. Imagine, for instance, that factions affiliated with the Palestinian Authority are now accusing the Palestinian resistance groups of being part of an external agenda. This is one of the consequences of such interference. Given these circumstances, the resistance forces must, to the greatest extent possible, work to bridge internal divides, reinforce national unity, and rebuild connections with liberation and resistance movements across the Arab world and beyond. They must do so without getting entangled in the sectarian and religious divisions that external forces are attempting to impose on the region. After all, the primary target of extremist projects has always been the resistance itself, something we witness clearly in the aftermath of the Syrian conflict and the transformations that followed. Today, the resistance bears a double responsibility. Above all, it must safeguard its very existence and strengthen its ranks. Beyond that, it must strive to establish the broadest possible network of relations and cooperation, both internally and regionally. This will be a crucial battlefield in resisting the larger Arab Zionist project that seeks to dismantle the resistance from within, from Gaza to Lebanon and beyond. This struggle will only become more challenging. Whether in Lebanon or Gaza, the resistance will face a new phase of confrontation, one that seeks to exploit the aftermath of the aggression, particularly in the economic, humanitarian, and reconstruction spheres, as well as through the intensification of the siege. This demands a dual effort, resisting attempts to isolate and delegitimize the resistance internally, while simultaneously building political bridges and engaging with all relevant actors where necessary. In Lebanon, we already see the resistance operating with exceptional precision and responsibility in this regard. In Gaza, the situation is different, as the resistance remains under relentless bombardment and massacres. However, there is no alternative to this strategy, both in the immediate term and in the crucial period following a ceasefire.
Well, the United Arab Emirates, Mr. Hamza, presents itself as a humanitarian actor in Gaza, and it does help with humanitarian aid while simultaneously enabling Zionist Israel in its aggression and in the displacement efforts. How does this publicly really impact this duplicity that they're working with? How does it impact publicly the resistance? And what role does media exposure in this specific area plays in maybe countering such narratives to say that no, Palestinians want to stay in Palestine?
In the first part of the question, we discussed the functional role of entities like the UAE and others in dismantling internal sources of strength within societies targeted by the Americans and Zionists. Today, we focus specifically on Gaza, where internal contradictions have been deliberately fostered to weaken national unity. Fragmentation projects have been promoted, pitting opposing narratives against each other. As we mentioned earlier, the resistance project has been labeled a foreign, Persian endeavor to be rejected, while surrendering to the Zionist entity is portrayed as the legitimate Arab choice. We have begun hearing this rhetoric not only in Palestine, but also in Lebanon, where some voices, including ministers and political parties, are now openly advocating for peace with the Zionist entity, despite the fact that such a stance blatantly contradicts the Lebanese constitution, as well as all national laws and conventions. Even the Taif Agreement, brokered by Saudi Arabia in 1991, and which shaped Lebanon's post-war political landscape, is now being reinterpreted to suit this new agenda. As long as this serves the ultimate goal of undermining internal unity and isolating the resistance, Saudi Arabia itself has shifted its reading of the agreement to align with this objective. In the second part of the question, the role of media becomes crucial. The media, journalists, news organizations, and social media activists, must now recognize that they are no longer operating on the periphery of this battle. They have become a central front in the struggle. Their responsibility is to expose these schemes, highlight their dangerous implications, and refocus attention on the core issue, Palestine. This is not just about Gaza, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, or Syria in isolation. These fronts are interconnected, targeted both through direct Zionist aggression and through the broader objective of dragging the entire region into normalization after dismantling the resistance. One of the fundamental purposes of International Quds Day, established by Imam Khomeini and observed annually on the last Friday of Ramadan, is to serve as a unifying occasion for Arab and Muslim nations under a single cause, confronting and resisting these projects. The first and foremost target of these schemes is the Palestinian cause itself, which is deliberately being diluted by diverting Arab and Muslim attention towards sectarian strife and media-driven divisions. This is precisely what numerous Arab and Muslim actors are attempting to do, using media programs, extremist narratives, and divisive rhetoric to sow discord day and night.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Khanza, political commentator and journalist at the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar, for joining us to talk about these new conspiracies that are being woven against the Palestinian people. Thank you very much. And ladies and gents, thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
We once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program, The Teacher. Please stay with us.
What will we say? Front of it, Mu'allim.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the most important Islamic teachings and concepts. I'm Ata, the host of this program. Brother Alavian and Sheikh Rouhani are the special guest speakers for today's discussion. Brother Alavian, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
All right. Another famous prophetic hadith regarding Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam mentioned in both Shia and Sunni references and authentic ones is Husseinun minni wa ana min Hussein. Hussein is from me and I am from Hussein, or Hussein belongs to me and I belong to Hussein. It could be translated in different way. Hussein is of me and I am of Hussein. Okay, this is also a rough translation. This is really, we can say, an authentic hadith by Prophet Muhammad regarding Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you. Give us the context in which this hadith was produced by Prophet Muhammad. What does it mean exactly and why Prophet Muhammad said such a statement about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This prophetic hadith indicates that there is a kind of unity, or can say spiritual unity, between Imam Hussein and the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. According to this hadith, the spirit of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and Abu Abdullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam is a kind of one single spirit or one single soul. That the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says that Hussein minni wa ana min Hussein. It means that we are the same light. We are the same divine light. We are the same light of guidance for the ummah, for the people. And also it indicates the